All right, back on the record, June 4th, 2025, 10:50 a.m. on the Silverview appeals. Ms. Clungeon was in cross-examination of Mr. Smith. So Ms. Clungeon, go ahead.
Yeah, it'll be relatively brief, but just for the examiner and everyone, while we're talking about these other examples, the North Beach and the Rivulet, I just wanted to show an image of what it is. These are just available on Google, mostly as illustrative in purpose, but wanted to bring those up. Let's see here. So okay. Are you able to see my screen there?
Yes.
Okay. So I know we had a small version of this photo in the applicant's feasibility report, but I just wanted to kind of blow this up here to better illustrate that there is in fact this under building parking here. So Mr. Smith, you said you did review this project.
Yes.
Right. And is there's one level of parking under this unit, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So they didn't do multiple down, didn't have to excavate significant amounts on this site, correct?
They did.
Okay. And this is not a garden style apartment, right?
No.
Okay. And then let's see here. Just have kind of a few other ones. Again, these are all from Google and I can provide them as kind of illustrative, but okay. And would this be another angle of this building?
Yes.
Okay. And which direction would we be looking?
We're looking due south.
Okay.
Towards, this is along the Clear Creek, which is a shoreline of the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's the Clear Creek would be over to the left side where all those trees are. Is that?
Yes.
Okay. And that's looking toward Dyes Inlet?
Yeah.
Okay. And where would the Silverdale site be in relation to this photo?
Are you talking about North Beach?
Sure. The Silverview is what I meant to say. The Silverview project be in relation to this one.
Let me see here. It'd be to the east.
Okay. So over kind of in this direction?
Yeah.
Behind the trees?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, and then one more. And would you agree that this is also kind of a relatively flat site?
Relatively flat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's just kind
it's
of
a very thing. It's a constrained site because of you got Blaine Avenue and you got the Clear Creek with a 100-foot buffer right there.
Okay. All right, and then you're able to see this as kind of a closer in, us again showing this parking under the building, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And this is, are all of these buildings roughly about two floors of residential apartments?
Yes.
Okay. And up one more. And again, these are just all from the Rivulet, their website, and Google Images. But here, one last one here, sort of showing that they're showing this parking under the building. And then is this structure jutting out here? Are those stairs or elevators or something along those lines? Do you recall from your review?
I do not recall.
Okay. All right. And would you agree that this project that you approved here, this was consistent with Silverdale design standards?
Yes.
Okay. All right. All right. So just turning back a little bit to the feasibility, you know, you kind of mentioned, I just want to clarify that when you are reviewing a project and where it says, you know, parking will be under building where feasible, you're only looking at the design that's presented to you by the applicant. You're not suggesting any designs that actually could make the make it feasible, correct?
Well, yeah, that's correct.
Okay. So, you know, if I were to do some sort of, I could do a 20 unit apartment building or something, and then if the requirement is to put the parking underneath, and I was like, hey, this doesn't pencil out for me financially, and because of that, it's not feasible. So would you agree that standard doesn't apply in the waterfront district?
Well, the design standard says that if it's determined infeasible, they don't have to do it. So that's what we were reviewing.
Okay, so I'm just saying, if I design a project where it's just not feasible, does that mean that if you were reviewing the project, that standard doesn't apply?
Well, if it doesn't, this standard is not being applied to the development, it's up to the developer to determine if it's feasible or not.
Okay. So you're saying it's up to the developer to determine if it's feasible, and you would accept whatever.
Well, if it's not a requirement in this particular case, it is a requirement to demonstrate, and hearing examiners asked it for a feasibility analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So is my video on?
It is not.
I can't seem to get it to get going.
No.
There we go. Awesome.
Okay, there we go. Okay, great. So you're saying it's up to the developer to design something that would be feasible and present that to you, correct?
They would determine if it's feasible or not, but they have to, in this particular case, they have to demonstrate that based on feasible analysis that they can't accommodate structured parking.
Okay. But my point is, if I just say I'm a developer and I design a project that is not feasible to comply with this design standard, this requirement in this district, when you are reviewing it as the county, if I've decided it's not feasible, do you then agree that standard doesn't apply to my
well,
project
if based
in
on,
order to make it feasible?
Yeah, well, based on the findings that we make, based on their analysis, then we would say, yes, that would be the case. Established, we have to look at what are the findings that they make, and we make a determination.
Okay. All right. So it's your position that it's not the county's role to determine whether there could be a feasible, whether it could be feasible, whether the applicant could design a project that would still accomplish their goals, but be financially feasible on the site. Is that correct?
But that doesn't mean that if there was a potential that it would be feasible, we might take a different tact.
Okay. Oh, so you're saying if there was a where it could be feasible, what do you mean take a different tact?
Well, based on site conditions and the project design, there might be a possibility that we'd take a different tact, far as saying, well, it might be feasible to have structured parking. But this particular case, staff believes that the applicant has made an argument that can be supported.
Okay, but that's based on their garden style design, right?
It's based on the overall review of their project, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But there have been no recommendations from the county to maybe come up with a different design.
No.
Okay. Just getting back to the Rivulet apartment, I just had one follow-up question. Let me find the right image. Right. Am I sharing my screen? Hold on.
Not yet.
No, not yet. Okay. It would be leave this photo. Okay. Are you able to see that?
Yes.
Okay. So here, this Revealet example, we have this single story of structured parking under the building. Did you consider basically whether say this? Would you agree that on this Rivulet site there wasn't significant excavation in order to achieve this level of parking?
Based on the gradient, no, I don't think there was as much excavation as mm-hmm. as other sites.
Mm-hmm. And so, if the applicant were to come to you with a project similar to this on this proposed site, would you say that it complies with the design standards, the waterfront design standard, to put structure parking under the building?
If the site condition would dictate that, that would be compliant as far as meeting the design standards, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and in your opinion, if you were to review this, do you think a project like this could be feasible at the site?
All sites are different. Based on the footings, I don't know how deep the footings are and mm-hmm. how large they are. So I could not confirm that would work at the
mm-hmm.
at the subject property.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But assuming it does work with the footings, right?
Well, yeah. If the groundwater conditions are different, maybe the applicant would have pursued that more. But at this point in time, that's not being proposed by the applicant.
Okay, so you, in your opinion, that this groundwater constraint is the primary reason for infeasibility?
Yeah, that seems to be the linchpin to a lot of this.
Okay. So if they were to propose a design that did not excavate more than the previous proposal, would you agree that it would be feasible?
Well, it depends on the other site conditions that are involved. A, it's against an urban restricted zone. Mm-hmm. Was it the even like Maynard's kitchen complained about view impacts? Also was brought up about if they were supposed to, they're supposed to be respectful to the urban restricted zone mm-hmm. where there's single family homes. You know, we have to weigh all those issues to determine if that's actually being achieved. Based on what the hearing examiners proposed is stepping back the development from the property line, I think we'll go a ways to help make that project respectful.
Okay.
As far as making it more compatible with.
Okay, and it's stepping down from to what height?
I believe it's 36, 35 feet, I believe, maybe as far as the top okay. elevation.
And do you know how tall these buildings are?
35 to 40.
Okay. 40, so basically this entire building would be similar to the small portion that's stepped down on the site.
Well, I think I have to look at the the design again. It's going to be a single story up against the property line. I think I need to, I believe I misspoke.
A single story.
Yeah, it's going to be a single story up against the property line along the urban restricted zone. That's what the intent is. So you don't have a tall building towering over the property line. That's
okay. But so single story to roughly the same height as this entire.
No, I'd say a bit lower.
Okay, a little bit lower. Yeah. I might actually just need to check that because my understanding is that there are two stories. Would you be surprised if there were two stories?
Well, the whole idea was that there was an attempt made to step down the project against the property line. That's the main concept.
Okay. But only for a small portion of the building.
Once we get further down the line far as site development activity permit and the building permit review, we'll look at that and see how that's going to be implemented.
Mm-hmm. And so you made a comment about kind of preserve about views, right? Where there were some view concerns. Do you think that the Silverview proposed project maintains views for Maynard's restaurant?
Well, there's going to be some view impacts, but right now my understanding is that there are some views with this proposal of the Olympic Mountains. However, if the building height is increased, there might be additional view impacts.
Would you agree that the configuration or the layout of the buildings in that kind of angled way maximizes the view obstruction from Maynard's?
Well, again, this is brought up earlier. This is not a zone where there's a view protection. Mm-hmm. Per se, it's not in a shoreline zone, or it's not like within the Ilhi Greenbelt or Manchester or something like that, where we actually have view protection overlays. Mm-hmm.
There is language about in the waterfront district. One of the main characteristics or features is
it's a design objective, but it's mm-hmm. not a hard mm-hmm. line.
Okay. And I also just brought that up because you indicated that was one of the things that you would consider in reviewing.
Yeah. But the thing is that Maynard's did brought the issue up. And so we have to consider it.
Right. But it was my understanding that the county and the applicant's version of considering it was just we don't have to protect this.
Not to the same degree because it's not an outright requirement, but we have to consider it based on it's a comment made by a adjacent property owner, and we have to look at it, analyze it. However, like this is different from what the applicant's proposing. This project here is different from what's being proposed at the subject property, but this is one large continuous building where there's four separate buildings with space going between it. So that view, there's like a solid view line like this one.
Okay. Were you present at the previous hearing?
Oh, yes.
Okay. It's been a while, fresh my memory. Do you recall Mr. Adams' exhibit sort of showing how the angle of the view completely obstructed the view from Maynard?
I remember him. Yeah. I don't know. I couldn't verify that. Okay. It seemed it was, I couldn't verify the dimensions or, it was, I think it's more illustrative of what it might be.
Would you agree with this characterization where it's kind of similar to Venetian blinds?
You could say that from a general observation, but that's not my position to characterize it that way.
Okay. Would you agree that there are configurations or designs that could improve the view for Maynard's while still developing this site?
But that's a matter that Maynard's and the applicant have to work out. There could be different designs, but that's not in my my purview to determine that at this point.
Okay. In projects that you've been involved in, have you seen where a design or a configuration of the building changes throughout the course of the application process and the review process?
Not too much. If the applicant's done enough site analysis based on site conditions, access, a lot of times the applicant has these details worked out. The biggest changes have been fire apparatus access, where things have to change as far as the configuration, because providing alternative routes. So there's more than one route to a project based on the number of units and density.
Mm-hmm. But just kind of yes or no, have you seen in your review where the design changes throughout the course of the review?
Yes.
Okay. Examples where maybe the location or placement of a building is adjusted?
Yes.
Maybe the height?
No, not likely.
No. You've never seen an adjustment of height changes?
No.
Okay. Number of parking.
Yeah. Okay. It depends.
Okay. Maybe changes in the number of proposed units?
Yes.
Okay.
It changed. If I increased and decreased, depends. Mm-hmm.
And is those increases or decreases usually based on, code requirements or some design standards or things like that?
Yes.
Okay. Have you encountered sites where maybe they can't achieve the maximum density allowed because of some of those code or design requirements?
Yes, based on usually it's like a net developable area doesn't mm-hmm. support it.
Okay.
Or access.
Mm-hmm. Or what about parking?
Not necessarily.
Okay. For reviewing the feasibility, I know I'm not sure if you're holding yourself out as any sort of market expert or anything like that, but did you review the market analysis provided by the applicant in the feasibility study?
Yeah.
Okay. Was there any review of that by, what was that review in the county? Did you just accept what was provided, or was there any verification of those numbers or anything like
no,
that?
No, that's not our position to verify the numbers.
Okay.
But we look at, is it logical?
Mm-hmm.
Does it make sense as far as mm-hmm. their argument? And based on their argument, that did would seem plausible.
Okay. Would you agree in that market analysis, do you recall that a lot of the figures that were in there were averages?
Yes.
Okay.
Because it's all estimates anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
But so they were averages. So presumably there's kind of significant, there might be a number of apartment buildings where they're in the higher end or lower than that. Right.
Right.
And to some extent, wouldn't those numbers be dictated by things like location or quality of fixtures or amenities or things like parking, like structured parking, elevators, things like that?
So based on averaging, mm-hmm. so it's a best guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but so when the applicant said, it would require an additional few hundred dollars a month and that people won't pay that, there was no analysis of what the high end of what people are or will pay within the Silverdale area, correct?
They made an estimate based on what the market will bear, and based on not having a definition of feasibility, staff accepted their hypothesis.
Okay. In your time at the county, have you ever disagreed with an applicant's feasibility analysis?
Yes.
And when was that?
Well, it's been a long time. It was based on economic circumstances, based on maybe a variance or something to that effect.
Okay, so the project wanted a variance from the code.
Yeah. And it was based on economic impacts. I believe that's what it was.
Okay. Do you rec any other details about that project or where or when?
We have findings that we have to review a project against and determine if it's the minimum necessary. Are there other property, people with property, same property rights in the area? And is it the minute, you know, is it something they created? That's what we would review against as far as a variance. And economic impacts is not something that's entirely reviewed against as far as something like that.
Sorry, I'm not quite following. What are
We review it. We have criteria we have to follow for a variance. It's not economic impacts.
Okay, so there's feasibility language in your variance code or in your
No,
no? Okay.
but that's what I think you asked me what the if that argument was made, and then we did we accept it? In
Okay.
that particular case, no.
Okay, so you didn't accept it, but it was not the feasibility wasn't a criteria of the variant that you were reviewing as part of the variance,
That's
correct?
correct.
Okay. So basically they made an argument based on something that was not, there was no basis in the code.
Right.
Okay. However, here we do have this feasibility language in the design standards, right?
Yes, that's
Okay.
correct.
Okay. So maybe I should reframe the question. Have you ever challenged a feasibility analysis when it's required by the design standards?
No.
Okay. All right, no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Okay, I get back to Minnesota. Any redirect?
Yes, a few, Mr. Examiner. Thank you. Mr. Smith, you were asked a bit about other projects in the Silverdale area, specifically one called North Beach and maybe one, is that the same as the Juvelet? No, different?
Rivulet, different.
Do you know, to your knowledge, of those project sites, are they comparable to this project site for Silverview, as in lot size, the terrain, groundwater, the aquifer underneath, building standards, code, zoning?
The zoning was comparable. Far as some this size, this site is a little bit larger than those other parcels. They have different groundwater conditions because that's something that was inquired about with the North Beach site was potential groundwater impacts. At that point in time, the applicant said they didn't anticipate, and if it was anticipated, they would d deal with far as any kind of groundwater intrusion, but then not anything where there's a potential impact to like if there's a situation of an artesian type water discharge.
Okay, so in terms of the aquifer, then these this project site compared to that project site is not similar.
Can you repeat that again?
In terms of the aquifer for this site, it's not comparable to the project of North Beach.
No.
Okay, and so comparing the two would be Not exactly.
Yeah, apple and oranges, I guess you could say.
Okay, perfect. That's all the questions I have for you. Thank you so much.
Can I actually kind of, I'm not sure if I have the ability to do a redirect, but I kind of need to.
Sure. Recross is what it is, but yes, for rebuttal. Yeah. Go ahead.
Right. Okay. I'm just going to share this document here. Are you able to see this?
And Ms. Klintz, can you identify what that document is?
Yes. So this was the document we previously showed for the North Beach. This is the county's staff report on the North Beach project that's located nearby. And I, you know, at this point, I've heard multiple things saying he testified that the aquifer and groundwater conditions are different from that site versus this site. Mr. Smith, if this is the staff report. County staff report on North Beach. This is PDF page 8. Would you agree that artesian aquifer vulnerability was one of the issues for the North Beach project?
Yeah, but it says here the excavations associated with this proposed development do not present a significant risk to breaching the till or cause uncontrolled aquifer discharge.
Right.
Okay. So that's different from what is being proposed at the Silverview site.
Mr. Examiner, I'd just like to lodge objection again onto this document. I raised it before, but we're seeing a tiny bit of it. It wasn't produced before. I don't know what other analysis was in here. I don't know what the structural analysis was for the project. And so I'm at a loss as to how I, you know, how to deal with it, you know, again, being caught up in sort of this
narrative. I understand. I mean, it certainly is within the scope of rebuttal to the testimony. I mean, Mr. Schutz, if you need a chance to look at the the staff report, that kind of thing, post hearing and respond, I'll certainly give you that chance if you want, and certainly ask Ms. Klingen to email Ms. Klingen a copy of the staff report to Mr. Schutz so he can take a look and see if he needs any further information.
Sure.
Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But so here we have this where it says the footing excavations will be approximately 2 feet deeper than the elevation of the finished floor, right?
Yes.
I believe.
Yeah.
And so then we've got this report where there's still, you know, thickness below the till for the bottom of the proposed excavations, right?
Yes.
Okay. Isn't that pretty similar language to the Robinson Noble report that was provided for the Silverdale for this project?
No, it's different.
Where they determined that there was an aquifer, that there was vulnerability.
No, this is different because it's been documented that there's 10 to 12 feet of fill on this site when it was a concrete batching plant. Because this has been documented by the state Department of Archaeology, because there's a potential for indigenous artifacts below the property. So that's being investigated. So this is a whole different ball game because of the fill.
Okay. Do you recall from your review of this project, the depth between the base of the basically, do you recall the depth between the foundation and the aquifer for the North Beach project?
No, I do not. But okay. I do remember what they indicated as far as how deep it would be.
Okay. But would you agree that the North Beach project similarly had an aquifer?
No, I would.
Aquifer vulnerability?
No, doesn't, as far as I know. Based on what the information I staff reviewed.
So there is not an artesian aquifer underneath the North Beach site?
Best of my knowledge, no.
Okay. Yeah, I would like to introduce this. I will email everyone a copy of this exhibit.
Okay. And Mr. Schutz, you can cross-examine Mr. Smith on this now if you like, or we can set that up later after we've had a chance to look at these documents, either way.
May I chime in on this, Mr. Hearing Examiner?
Okay, let me finish with Mr. Schutz and then I'll get to you, Mr. Wachter. But Mr. Schutz, did you want to cross at all or not?
I think just briefly.
Just need a chance to look at the documents?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I guess I'd like the opportunity if something drastic comes up. Okay. But for now, I guess I would just ask Mr. Smith. So Robinson & Noble was the consultant on that project with regard to aquifer issues?
Yes.
Okay. And they determined that on that site, there was no, you know, the digging that was allowed, those foundations could be dug and it was okay with regard to breaching the till of the aquifer.
Based on the amount of fill on site, they might not breach the aquifer at all.
No, because... I'm sorry. I must have stated that poorly. They determined that the foundations, as described in the report we were just looking at, and as proposed by the applicant on that site, were not in danger of breaching the aquifer. Those foundations were okay at that depth.
That is correct.
That site. But Robinson Noble has also chimed in on this site, correct?
That's correct.
And they've made a determination that digging any deeper than the proposed plan would be a very bad idea. Is that correct?
Yes, based on a two-phase analysis, based on what was proposed the first time, and they went back again and dug new test holes.
So they've been on both sites, and they came to two very different determinations based on the differences in sites.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Mr. Wachter.
Yeah, Your Honor, just, I'm sorry, I keep saying Your Honor, it's a holdover from a lot of time in court, certainly more than in the hearing examiner setting. You know, I just object to the possible admission of the materials that counsel is presenting regarding alternate sites. There simply isn't foundation to demonstrate that they are in any way comparable. And frankly, her questioning of the witness was unfair and confusing and was filled with incomplete hypotheticals. You know, I trust that you can sort that stuff out, but at the same time, it makes for a very confused record. It wasn't even clear what specific projects she was asking about at any given time. I just think, you know, I make this objection for the record that this is certainly getting way beyond the scope of the remand, and the witness raised no testimony that opened doors to that kind of questioning regarding reports that are simply just untethered to the facts of the Silverview project.
Ms. Clungeon?
Yeah, I want to withdraw that. I had two documents mixed up, so just... I'll withdraw that. It was a different staff report. So that was my error. I was just about to send it to everyone and the titles were mixed up.
So just striking all the testimony related to that document then? I would think if it was a different project than you represented that we have to, right?
Right, exactly. Okay. Yeah. I think there's still a question about whether there's an aquifer under the site, but I don't have documents one way or the other.
Okay. So all the testimony regarding that staff report is stricken from the record. Okay. All right. Ms. Oda, anything else? I guess I'm bouncing back to you.
No, Mr. Examiner.
Okay. All right, Mr. Smith, I was going to say you got off easy until we got to Ms. Clungeon, and then things got a little more complicated for you, but you made it. Thank you. It's very helpful testimony. All right. So, Mr. Walker, anyone else from the city or county? Sorry.
Yes, Mr. Examiner, I believe that completes our presentation of witness testimony. We'll obviously stand by for the other party's rebuttal witnesses.
Okay. All right. So, I guess back to Ms. Clungeon. You said, I know you had Ms. Cook as a rebuttal. Of course, we've got Mr. Adams at 1:00. Did you have any other rebuttal witnesses or where are we at?
Nope, it would just be Cook and Adams. Okay. Although I believe Mr. Adams is unavailable for a period, and his understanding was that he was going to come back, I think, after 2.
Oh, it's a 2. Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's get started with Ms. Cook then, and then might have a little break between her testimony and Mr. Adams.
Mr. Examiner, I just wanted, could I just get on the record to make sure we're procedurally, so we have several rebuttal witnesses as well. Mm-hmm. two for building and two for wetland. The idea is that Sarah Cook would go, Dr. Sarah Cook would go now, and then we'd present our four at the end. Is that how this works?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, ideally, hopefully we don't have a space between Ms. Cook and Mr. Adams at two, but if we do, we'll bring in your witnesses a little out of order, but you know, just so we can get done today.
Procedurally, yeah, I thought the idea was that the applicant has the burden on the design on the parking, but the appellant had the burden on the wetlands. So it wouldn't, we would have the final opportunity after
I thought by email we had agreed at least the applicant would go first on both so that we wouldn't have to bounce back and forth.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So I don't know if the final rebuttal order was specified, but it's kind of the same concept where it was just simpler to have them do it all at once, is my recollection. But if there's something that needs a rebuttal, I'm very flexible on that. If something comes up that you need to respond to, you know, for all parties, I'm pretty flexible about it. So,
okay.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. We would just like the opportunity for a rebuttal after we hear from witnesses that I guess we have not heard from before.
Yeah. Something new comes up. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Well, let's bring up Dr. Cook for at least the next half hour. So.
Okay. I will bring Dr. Sarah Cook over here. Okay, she should be over. Okay, there she is.
All right, so I would tell everyone that I cannot get this on my computer. The link was not working this morning for whatever reason, so I'm having to do this on my phone. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's too bad. We can see you pretty well. So let's swear you in real quick. Do you swear affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay, perfect. All right, Ms. Clungeon, go ahead.
Hey. Morning, Dr. Cook. Were you present for Mr. Wright's testimony this morning?
Yes, I was.
Okay. And let's see here. I have to collect my thoughts. Regarding his review of the SVC data, you know, he indicated, made some statements about testing the distance between their plots and his plots. And in your experience, you know, did he test in the same or similar areas or areas in way that at all corresponded to your delineation plots?
No, he did not. And there's a couple of points to that. He stated up front that he didn't compare the table one from the SVC July report. He didn't compare my data points and the SVC data points. He only looked at the SVC data points and he placed his points within 8 to 10 feet of their points. And so, as I stated yesterday, you end up with three sampling points, not in the same location, because I feel that I established yesterday that the SVC sample points were not near my data points. The vegetation was completely different. And Mr. Wright obscured the fact that he hadn't even looked at the composition of my data points. And if he had, he would have seen that for two of the three data points that I had that were in the wetland, two of them were in a vegetation community that would not only not have changed across the season, but would not have changed across years.
And which vegetation community is that?
That would be the reed canary grass for the one plot, which you actually misstated when you were questioning him. It wasn't the predominance of the wetland, but it was a portion of the wetland. There was a monostand of reed canary grass. And they hadn't even looked at any of those areas, which were in that central wetland. They were east and north of that DP 16 and my data point 2 that we spent all that time on yesterday and today. And second of the three plots was a tall fescue dominant plot. Again, a very robust species that would not have been outcompeted by anything else and would have been present at the early part of the growing season through the entire growing season. So although I don't dispute that in some meadows there are vernal species, meaning that they're only there in the early part of the growing season, that is not applicable for two of the three data plots. And actually the third data plot had some dominant species that also would have been present in the early part of the growing season. So that statement does not apply in this situation. So you can bring up that fact. It is indeed a fact, but it doesn't apply in this wetland. So all three of us sampled in three different locations. And had he compared, Mr. Wright specifically stated that he had not done a comparison of that table three of the data from my data plots and SVC's data plots, he would have seen that the vegetation, the soils, and the hydrology, nothing matched between those points. And in fact, as I stated yesterday, if you then added his data points, his didn't even match SVC's, and that's not a matter of there being a difference between time, because he did his sampling in the latter part of the year, and so they were only months apart, and nothing was done in the spring. So there was July, and then later than July. So that his statement that there are these early season species that don't persist throughout the year doesn't apply to even the work he did in comparing his work with SVC's work. And I would also mention that stating that the zone of disturbance is 8 to 10 feet is absolutely ridiculous. You think about this, you dig a hole, you cast the soil just on the side of the hole. So the hole is maybe 6, 8, 10, maybe at the most 12 inches in width. And then you've got a mound of soil on the side of that, which is, being liberal, another 12 inches. It's not like you're throwing it up in the air and casting it all over the place. And people trudging around on the top is going to disturb the vegetation, but it isn't going to disturb the soil profiles. So it is not an 8 to 10 feet area of disturbance. It's a kind of 2 to 3 foot area of disturbance. So I really don't understand that statement at all. That's not science. That's not how we do things, and that's not correct. And so sampling quite so far, and again, I will remind everyone that a wetland boundary is a line. And on one side of the line, you have wetland, and on the other side of the line, you have upland. So if you're sampling 8 to 10 feet away, it's very obvious that I could easily have been sampling in wetland, and 8 to 10 feet away is on the other side of the line, and you're sampling upland. And if you look at, and I can't bring them up because I can't get Zoom on my computer, but if you bring up the SVC mapping and then you bring up my mapping, you can see that the bulk of my wetland area, neither Radicke, especially since that's who we're talking about, didn't investigate the almost 80% of the wetland area that I had identified. And that also includes, if you were to overlay the map that Diane Hennessy did of her 5,000 plus square foot wetland, there was no assessment of that. So Mr. Wright also stated later that while it wasn't his task to verify the wetland boundaries, he felt comfortable, and I think that, believe that was his word, that the boundary was accurate. Well, he didn't look at the boundary. He didn't look at my boundary, and he didn't look at SVC's overall boundary, because that's not what he was tasked to do.
And also, just for the record here, so I've got F18. This is PDF page 42, kind of showing the map that Dr. Cook was referencing. So can you explain what you mean when they you say they didn't test between your pit, your points, and the inner points?
If you see that, if you blow that up, their data point 16 and my data point 2, if you were to pull up my map, those are on the very southwestern edge of my wetland. So the southeastern portion and the whole northern portion, with the exception of one data point on the east, which was my data point 3, and one data point on the west, which was my data point 4, and remembering that my data point 5 was outside of the wetland, if you were to pull up my map, you would see that the bulk of my wetland, they didn't investigate. They only looked at those 5 data points, 2 of which were in upland and 3 of which were in the wetland. They didn't look at the rest of my wetland boundary and didn't investigate. And again, if you're 8 to 10 feet away and you're just in the proximity of my wetland, it's very easy to not be in the wetland because the points were on the margin of the wetland and they were 8 to Mr. Scholes and SVC were in the vicinity and Radicke was 8 to 10 feet away from the SVC points. So it's very easy to see that they sampled. And if you look at their data, and again, I'm not questioning their data other than how they read it. Their data was their data. If you do that, you see that clearly they were in upland, and if you look at mine, clearly I was in wetland. So they're not sampling in the same location, and that is the big issue here. And then there were a couple of other things that Mr. Wright said that I wholeheartedly disagree with because they weren't accurate. The soils in the data plot. For the SVC, both the July and the October reports, Mr. Wright stated that he didn't review that. And then you brought up the fact that you just pulled up one of the plots. There were quite a few where the soils within the top 10 inches had a chroma of 1 or a chroma of 2 with rhodopsomorphic features. And they had stated that it was less than 99%. That the redox features were less than 1% of the thing. And as I had stated yesterday, that's not the current research. And I dug up the articles last night. There was one from 1997 by Vaproskis and Sprechter. Vaproskis is the one who is the senior author on almost every single one of the hydric soil indicator manuals that we brought up one yesterday. And the 1997 article emphasizes the subjectivity, I'm just reading their abstract, and variability of visual redox feature identification. Then there was a Raven, and I'll talk about what he found. Ravenhorst 2008 evaluated thresholds of iron and manganese concentration. So that's those models. And then there's another thing, manganese also forms little precipitants within the soil and their correlation to visible redox features. And USDA NRCS Soil Technical Note 6 from 2002 explicitly notices that features occupying less than 5% of the matrix may not be consistently recognized, supporting a 5% practical threshold. And O'Donnell and et al. In 2010 in the journal Geoderma found that developed a method using digital image processing to identify and quantify redoxomorphic features from soil cores. He found that visual estimates often underrepresent those redox features, especially when features occupy less than 5% of the observed area. And if you look at the Vaproskis and Ravenhorst studies, what they basically say is they agreed that a visual estimate below 2 to 5% are highly unreliable, and less than 2% is not typically even visible. The USDA NRCS guidelines from 2017 through 2024 suggest a 5% threshold for reliable human identification, not 2%, which was what what was in the previous manuals. So Mr. Wright's information likely comes from when he was first learning delineation, when we did used to use 2%, but it's now been set at 5% so that if basically what they're saying is, if you detect redox features, the detection is even visually seeing them, it's at you at a 2% threshold, which is what the manual states is viable for saying something is a hydric soil if you have a chroma of 2. And if it's anything other than faint, it's above 5%. So those estimates in the SVC report were inaccurate. The fact that she saw the redox features meant that there was at least 2%, not less than 1. And for the areas where she stated that there was distinct redox features, it was likely above 5%. So every one of those data sheets that we looked at yesterday that I brought up and more that, because I stopped at a certain point because I'd made my point, there were more. That show where they said that the soils were not hydric, were in fact hydric if it had a redox or a chroma of 2 in, and there were redox features, and it was within the top 10 inches of the soil surface. And for the July report, they reported there was no hydrology, but then when they went back out in October, found both hydrology and vegetation. Anywhere where they were stating that there were redox features, those were actually wetland. And so Mr. Wright did not review that. He stated that they reviewed that. Now, one of the things that I would like to bring up is that Mr. Wright said that he looked at vegetation hydrology and soil indicators, but if you look at his report, that's exhibit F13, page 2, the bottom paragraph specifically reads, Radicchini Associates visited the site on July 25th, 2024 to confirm the findings of Soundview Consultants 2024 report. Specifically, our review focused on determining if hydric soil indicator A11 was met at these locations, as was the indicator discussed in the hearing examiner reconsideration. So even though he just stated in the hearing that they looked at everything, this is not what their report says that they did. And at the time, it was very clear to me that, reading this report and reading their report, that is all they did. When they took their own pits, they recorded everything. But when they were reviewing, they were not reviewing if SVC had done their plots virtually close to mine. They were just in the vicinity. And again, I've already discussed why that's problematic with respect to wetland boundaries. And two, they didn't compare their own data plots to the SVC reports, because had they done that, they would have seen that they were way far away. They were not in the vicinity. And again, if with respect to wetland boundaries, that 8 to 10 feet is the difference between being in a wetland and outside of a wetland. And so for one of their data plots, they sampled in the wetland, and for the other of their data plots, they, like SVC, had sampled outside of the wetland. So the statements that they, at both SVC and Radicchi, were legitimately reviewing whether or not my data points were wetland is inaccurate, because it's very clear that they weren't in the same location and that they didn't really do a comparison in the field of where the actual wetland boundary might be. And they also didn't look at the bulk of what I had delineated as wetland. They only went out to points that were right on the margin. the sample points, of which, again, I gave the data for five because I wasn't tasked to do a delineation in a full report. I was only out there to verify their wetland boundaries, which I felt was highly inaccurate, because at that point, when I went out, they had come up with 150 square feet of wetland. As I said, the only reason that I was GPSing data points was that it just, the wetland boundary just kept going. I went out to verify the 150 square feet, and I was finding lots and lots of wetlands. So I defined the entire boundary, which, you know, as you read from my report, ended up being over 8,000 square feet. And Diane Hennessy found over 5,000 square feet. And the tribes had not done any delineation, but they saw wetland out there, as did the Fish and Wildlife staff, Allison, if you go back in the record. So that's why, you know, I didn't document any more than my 5 points, but I had data for the other points. If you refer back to my wetland map and that blue one that I showed yesterday, which is in the record, because it's in my report, is an easier way to see my wetland boundaries. I think of all the things that Mr. Wright said, those were the main dominant things.
What about his statement that it wasn't, you know, he didn't consider it his role to question the DOE's DOE's delineation?
The hearing examiner himself brought out the point that it is the county's jurisdiction, and that they called the DOE in to provide a review for them that they would use in making their decisions. So the DOE doesn't have the right over the county to make a wetland boundary determination. They only have, they can present what they think their results are, and then the county uses that in making their own decision. The way the jurisdiction works is the Corps does have ultimate jurisdiction, but they decided not to put forth an opinion in this particular project. And I don't believe the county even asked them to. They could have. In all honesty, the appealants have the ability to contact the Corps and say, we believe there is a very large wetland that is going to be filled as a result of this project. There therefore will be a wetland impact, and it's significant. It's more than 1,000 square feet. So you should take jurisdiction, and the Corps has ultimate jurisdiction over the county and the state. But the state does not have jurisdiction over the county. So the state can make, and state being the Department of Ecology, can make recommendations. But the county has the ability to take those recommendations and ignore them. And, you know, I'll point out once again that as part of this whole taking the DOE's recommendations, the county should consider the fact that although the DOE did state that they agreed with the 355 square foot boundary in the field, that came from the head of the department who has no wetland background and is not a wetlands technical person, and that the two technical people, Neil Molstad and Diane Hennessy, both disagreed in the field, up front in front of everybody. And then Diane Hennessy wrote a letter after that, after her boss had stated that he agreed to the 355 square feet, that she had disagreed with that. And so the county should take all that into consideration, because that's all important. It doesn't ultimately matter if the head of the Department of Ecology makes that edict, because he doesn't have the jurisdiction to make the edict. It's only goes into the information that the county has to make that decision. And their decision should be include the fact that the actual technical people who were involved with the review disagreed with that call. So this is all data that the county can use to formulate their final opinion. And you know, were I in that situation, all of that is data that's salient to making a final decision on this.
Okay. All right. I think those were all the points. Is there anything else you'd like to address, or?
I'm sure there were a few other things that Mr. Wright said that I didn't necessarily agree with, but no, in general, I mean, basically the county tasked him to go out and look at the A11 indicators, and that's what he did, and that's all that he did. And to say that he did any more than that and he has an opinion on any more than that would be inaccurate. Expanding his scope is not really, you know, to anything more than that is really not helpful to anyone in terms of making the decision as to whether or not the third party review was useful. And as it turns out, as the hearing examiner said on Monday, it really wasn't his intent to just restrict the reevaluation to the A11. But unfortunately, that's how it was read by both SVC and the third party reviewer. And that's mostly all they did was to look at that A11 indicator rather than go back out and revisit whether or not, go back, look at my data points and reassess whether or not they found wetland in those areas. And I think that's not what anybody did. They did not go back out and sample right near where my points were. And so I don't think that this going back out and reevaluating was a successful endeavor on anybody's part. Again, I have the data. If they want to do that, they can. But you know, it remains that the agencies, technical staff at the Department of Ecology, the tribes, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, all stated that there was a large wetland in that meadow. I found it. Diane Hennessy found it visually, and we defined those boundaries. The tribes and Fish and Wildlife didn't define the boundaries, but they stated it was larger than either nothing or the 150 square feet. That doesn't mean 355 square feet. That doesn't mean 500 square feet. So there's a group of people, with the exception of the developers' consultants, who all think there's a large wetland out there. And I think that question still has not been answered by the county. And so I think that's where we are at this point in time.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Cook.
I think that's pretty perfect timing. Let's take our noon break. We'll see you at 1 o'clock.